Well, it's been encouraging this year to focus on our theme, the Servant's Invincible Heritage, as we celebrate the 70th year of ABC's existence, and what a wonderful heritage we have, as we've even had opportunities throughout this last semester to review the various persons on the banner and the impact that they've had on this ministry and the wonderful heritage that they have the privilege to be a part of. You know, this focus this year has brought to my mind my own heritage, and it's my privilege to have some of my family here. My sister Melissa and my mom have come, and I'm thankful for my heritage and how the Lord has worked in my family's life to bring us to this point. Years and years ago, after my dad served 20 years in the Army, we moved here as a family, and my dad came here as a student. And so I grew up down in the village in the Mary Student Housing, and then had the privilege then to come here as a student. And so it's just amazing. All of my family is our alumni of the college, and my parents served on staff for a while. My mom served over 20 years. And so I'm thankful for the heritage that I have and how the Lord has guided and directed to where I am today. You know, and as we think about the servant's invincible heritage, I'd like to take a moment and focus on that word invincible. What comes to your mind when you think of someone or something being invincible? Maybe you might think of a superhero being invincible because they have some kind of power or something like that. Or maybe you think of a particular athlete or a sports team as being invincible. Or maybe you hope that they are. Or maybe you thought when you were little or you know of a little kid who thinks their dad is invincible. You know, there's nothing to make you feel more proud as a father to hear your child tell another child, "My dad can beat up your dad." So we might think of our dads as being invincible. Or you might think of a military or a special forces as being invincible. I believe we have a pretty invincible military here in our own country, and I'm thankful for the men and women who serve to help us help it be that way. And while we can say or believe that these things are invincible, the true proof of their invincibility is seen when they are put to the test. A superhero proves he's invincible when he battles the villains. An athlete or sports team proves they're invincible as they defeat the other team. A military proves their invincibility as they defeat the enemy. And in the same way, the servant's invincible heritage is proven when it is put to the test. When we are faced with adversity, challenge, and conflict, we have the opportunity to either believe that it is truly invincible and follow after our heritage, or we doubt its invincibility and we forsake our heritage. So this morning I'd like to look at a group of people that had a pretty amazing heritage. And yet, even as their heritage was reviewed, similar to what we've been doing this year, we have some examples of persons who responded in different ways. Some followed their heritage, but some forsook it. And so the title of my message this morning is The Servant's Invincible Heritage, Followed or Forsaken? The Servant's Invincible Heritage, Followed or Forsaken? And the passage I'd like you to turn to now is 1 Samuel chapter 12. We'll begin in verse 6 of 1 Samuel chapter 12. We'll go through chapter 14 and verse 15. 1 Samuel chapter 12. Now we're at the point in Israel's history when the first king is being put into power. In fact, chapter 12 could be seen as somewhat the inauguration of their first king, Saul. And chapter 12 is somewhat the inauguration speech, if you will, given by Samuel as a challenge to their new leader and to the people. And if he had given a title to this speech, perhaps it would be this: the foundation for flourishing is our heritage. The foundation for flourishing is our heritage. We see that in chapter 12. We're going to begin in verse 6 through the end of the chapter. And let's begin with verses 6 through 11 as we see Samuel's counsel to remember our heritage. He begins with the counsel to remember. Verse 6. And Samuel said unto the people, "It is the Lord that advanced Moses and Aaron, and that brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore, stand still, that I may reason with you before the Lord of all the righteous acts that the Lord, of all the righteous acts of the Lord, which he did to you and to your fathers." In other words, Samuel says, "Let me remind you about our invincible heritage." And in the following verses, he gives them examples of all the things that the Lord had done for them as an example of their heritage. He says, "Remember how the Lord delivered your ancestors who were enslaved in Egypt. Remember your repentance and God's mercy as you turned back to the Lord from following idols. Remember the servants sent by God to deliver you from your enemies." So Samuel's counsel is to remember your heritage. But then this is followed by Samuel's criticism for rejecting their heritage in verses 12 and 13. His criticism for rejecting their heritage. "And when ye saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, ye said unto me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king. Now therefore, behold the king whom ye have chosen, and whom ye have desired, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you." So despite their amazing heritage that Samuel recounts for them, of all the things that the Lord had done for them, here they are up against a new enemy, and they doubt the sufficiency of the Lord to deliver them. And they demand a king. We see earlier in chapter 8, verse 20, some of the reasons why they wanted a king. It says, "That we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." They wanted someone to take care of their problems for them. And apparently they didn't think the Lord could do it. Can I tell you that the Lord is sufficient no matter what challenge may arise in our lives? As you pursue future ministries, many of you are going to be tempted to give up when things start to get tough. You're going to see others around you who have taken the easy road. They have their nice houses and their nice cars. And you're going to be tempted to give up when things get tough. You're going to question whether God is sufficient. Too many Christians who should be serving Jesus have been waylaid by the stuff of this world, by taking the easy road. Don't reject your heritage. Samuel's criticism of the people is that they had rejected their heritage in wanting a king like the other nations. And next we see Samuel's charge to restore their heritage. The charge to restore their heritage in verses 14 to the end of the chapter. After Samuel criticizes the people for rejecting their heritage, he gives them this charge in verses 14 and 15. "If ye will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall both ye and also the king that reigneth over you continue following the Lord your God." First off, we see the conditions for following their heritage. It's pretty simple. Fear the Lord, serve him, and obey him. Fear the Lord, serve him, and obey him. If we could get those three things down in our life, we'd be doing pretty well. The conditions for following then are followed by the caution of forsaking. In verse 15, "But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall the hand of the Lord be against you, as it was against your fathers. The caution of forsaking your heritage. He repeats his charge again at the end of the chapter in verses 24 and 25. Only fear the Lord and serve Him in truth with all your heart, for consider how great things He hath done for you. But if ye shall still do wickedly, ye shall be consumed, both ye and your king. What an important reminder that Samuel gives to the people of Israel at this point of transition of leadership. A counsel to remember, a criticism for rejecting, and a charge to restore their heritage. The foundation for flourishing is our heritage. And unfortunately, it doesn't take long for these words to be forgotten, because we see now in chapter 13 an example of failure in forsaking our heritage. Failure in forsaking our heritage. Follow along with me as I read the first 14 verses of chapter 13. Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, whereof 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. And the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba. And the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, Let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also was had in abomination with the Philistines. And the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal. And the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and pitched in Michmash eastward from Bethaven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves in caves and in thickets and in rocks and in high places and in pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was yet in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. So at the beginning of this chapter, we find Saul has been king now for a couple of years, and he's up against a new enemy, the Philistines. And so Saul forms an army, I'm sure, of select men that he chose, 3,000 men, 2,000 under his command and 1,000 under his son. And we see in verse 3 that Jonathan takes his troops and attacks this garrison, this outpost of the Philistines, and defeats them. And when the rest of the Philistines heard about it, they weren't too happy. And so they amassed their troops in force. And so Saul responds, and he tries to muster up additional troops from Israel, but without much success. So I'd like to suggest that the first failure we see here is a failure to fear the Lord in verses 1 through 7. A failure to fear the Lord. Now maybe you're wondering, how can I see a failure to fear the Lord here when the Lord isn't even mentioned? But therein lies the answer. This passage stands in stark contrast to another battle in chapter 11, where we can say the king-elect Saul is up against the Ammonites. And if you remember that passage, Saul sends out a message, and he musters up 330,000 Israelites to come against the Ammonites. And I believe the key to their victory is clearly seen throughout chapter 11. Verse 6, And the Spirit of God came upon Saul. Verse 7, The fear of the Lord fell on the people. And in verse 13, Saul gives credit to the Lord when he says, Today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. So it's clear to see in that battle that it was the proper fear of the Lord that led to their victory. And yet, in this passage, we find no reference to the Lord at all. In fact, verses 3 and 4 would have been a great opportunity for Saul to again give credit to the Lord for the attack on this garrison, but look again at instead what he said in verse 3. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten a garrison of the Philistines. Saul takes the credit for his own son's attack, and again, he's a king, so maybe it's right for him to take credit for that, but he should have really given credit to the Lord for defeating that garrison. The very thing that Samuel told them to do in chapter 12, fear the Lord, is completely absent in this account. And we see that Saul ends up with a very dismal response compared to the 330,000 men he gathered in chapter 11. In fact, even a large number of the men, the select men that he had chosen for his own army, had deserted him. And those that did stay, it says, were shaking in their boots. Not only was there a failure to fear the Lord, but next we see a failure to obey the Lord in verses 8 through 14. A failure to obey the Lord. Verse 8, "And he tarried 7 days according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. And Saul said, 'Bring hither a burnt offering to me and peace offerings.' And he offered the burnt offering, and it came to pass that as soon as he made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him that he might salute him. And Samuel said, 'What hast thou done?' And Saul said, 'Because I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Mishmash, therefore said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering.' And Samuel said to Saul, 'Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee.'" Okay, so what's the problem here? Isn't it a good thing now that Saul is making supplication to the Lord? He's offering sacrifices. We just criticized the fact that he didn't fear the Lord in the first 7 verses. So at least now he's trying to seek the Lord, right? But what's the problem? He was told to wait for Samuel to come to offer the sacrifices and to give instruction. And when he's confronted with his disobedience, what does he do? He begins to list a bunch of excuses. I saw the people were scattered from me, and you didn't come when you told me you were going to come, and the Philistines gathered themselves together to attack us. But Samuel says, "You've acted foolishly. You've not kept the Lord's commandment." And so in this failure to obey the Lord, first we see there's no rationalization for sin. There is no rationalization for sin. Have you ever tried to rationalize your sin to God? "Lord, I know I shouldn't have responded that way, but you don't know what it's like to live with my roommate. And besides, I was nice to him yesterday." Or, "Lord, I know I shouldn't have cheated on that test, but you know, I was up late serving you at my church, and I need to get a good grade to pass this class." There is no rationalization for sin. You've heard the phrase, "Obedience is better than sacrifice." Do you know who that was told to? This same man. Apparently, he didn't learn his lesson, because later on in chapter 15, he's told to completely destroy the Amalekites. But what does he do? He lets the king live. He takes the spoil of sheep and oxen. And again, he's confronted by Samuel for his disobedience. And Samuel says in verse 22 of chapter 15, "Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. It's never right to do wrong. The end does not justify the means. Sin is sin, and you cannot rationalize it away. There is no rationalization for sin. Not only that, but secondly, we see that there is repercussion for sin in verses 13 and 14. And Samuel said to Saul, "Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. But now thy kingdom shall not continue." Saul could have had an amazing heritage through the lineage that we know ultimately led to Christ. And yet because of his sin, this privilege was lost. You may never know the future opportunities that may be lost because of the sin you commit today. Remember, there is always repercussions for sin. So the failure to fear the Lord and the failure to obey the Lord. Let us learn from Saul's example of failure in forsaking his heritage. But thankfully, the story doesn't end there, because as we continue, we will see a good example in chapter 14, and we have an example of faith in following our heritage. Faith in following our heritage. Now, I talked earlier about how challenge gives us the opportunity to prove the invincibility of our heritage. Well, we see the challenge that they were facing outlined in verses 15 through 23 of chapter 13. And I call it here the formidable challenge in verse 15 through 23. The formidable challenge that they were up against. This formidable challenge that caused Saul to forsake his heritage gives opportunity to exercise faith in following our heritage. Note first that they were outnumbered in verse 15. And Saul numbered the people that were present with him, about 600 men. So he's down to 600 men, as the others who were with him are now hiding in holes and caves. Some of them completely deserted him, went across the river back to their homes. 600 against 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and soldiers as the sand on the seashore. They were definitely outnumbered. Secondly, they were outmaneuvered in verse 17 and 18. And the spoilers came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned unto the way that leadeth to Ophrah, unto the land of Shual. And another company turned the way of Beth-horon. And another company turned the way to the border that looketh to the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. So not only did the Philistines have an established base camp, but they're sending out raiding parties in different directions to attack the enemy. So the Israelites were definitely outmaneuvered. And the third formidable challenge that they face is that they were outgunned in verses 19 through 23. Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears." And then jump down to verse 22. "So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan. But with Saul and with Jonathan his son was there found." Now, I'm no war analyst, but I can see that this is not a good situation. Not only are they down to just 300 soldiers, but only two of them have decent weapons. So they were definitely outgunned. Now, I doubt that any of you are going to come up against an army like this. But I am sure there's going to be times that you're going to feel in your life that you're outnumbered or outmaneuvered or outgunned. Perhaps you might even feel like that this week as you are facing the army of assignments and exams and projects. But no matter how formidable the challenge may be, we have an invincible heritage that we can rely on. Our theme verse that you see noted here on our banner, I think, is a great verse to claim when we're facing these challenges. Isaiah 54:17. No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord. So in chapter 14 now, the formidable challenge is followed by the incredible conquest. The incredible conquest in chapter 14. Follow along as I read. Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, Come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. And Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people that were with him were about 600 men. And Ahiah, the son of the Hittub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sina. The forefront of the one was situate northward over against Mishmash, and the other southward over against Gibeah. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, Come, and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. And his armor bearer said unto him, Do all that is in thine heart, turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. Then said Jonathan, Behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them. If they say thus unto us, Tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place, and will not go up unto them. But if they say thus, Come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand. And this shall be a sign unto us. And both of them discovered themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, Behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes where they have hid themselves. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, Come up unto us, and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said unto his armor-bearer, Come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor-bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer slew after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men, within, as it were, half an acre of land, which a yoke of oxen might plow. And there was trembling in the host, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the spoilers, they also trembled, and the earth quaked, so it was a very great trembling. I'd like you to quickly note six practical features of this incredible victory that I believe we can apply to our own lives as we face difficult circumstances. First, we see that Jonathan decided to take action. He decided to take action. In verse 1, he tells his armor bearer, Come, let us go over unto the Philistines' garrison. Now, that seems simple enough. And yet that's the first step you've got to take. You've got to decide to take action. But how often do we maybe act like Saul? And I like how it was described that he was sitting in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree. I can just picture him there sulking, fearing, trembling because of the challenge that he was facing. Or maybe we're like the soldiers who are hiding in the caves or fleeing out of fear. How do you react in the face of great challenges? Jonathan decided to take action. Second, he was determined in spite of obstacles. Determined in spite of obstacles. Verse 4 tells us that just to get to the enemy, he had a sharp rock on the one side that he had to climb down and a sharp rock on the other side that he had to climb up. They could have easily said, wait, this is too difficult. They could have turned around and went back at the very first obstacle they faced. But in verse 6, Jonathan again tells his armor bearer, come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. How do you respond when you come upon an obstacle? The first difficulty you face, do you turn around and go back? Lord, I can't do this. Jonathan was determined in spite of obstacles. The third feature of this example is that Jonathan had a devoted companion. A devoted companion. Unfortunately, I think the armor bearer easily gets overlooked in this account. But look at the deep devotion he shows Jonathan by his response in verse 7. Do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee. Behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. Another way to say it, he says, I'm with you heart and soul. When you're facing great challenges, it is important to surround yourself with godly companions, those who are willing to stick with you when the going gets tough. Jonathan had a devoted companion. Next, I think, is one of the most important features. We see that Jonathan had a doubtless faith in the Lord. A doubtless faith in the Lord. First, we see he had faith that God can give the victory. In the second part of verse 6, when he says, it may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. I believe that Jonathan recognized the power of God to save them, whether it was by an army of 300,000 or an army of two. I think he was listening closely to Samuel in chapter 11, when Samuel recounted all the times, or in chapter 12, that it was the Lord that saved Israel. And so here we see his doubtless faith in the fact that God can give the victory. But not only that, I believe he believed that God will give the victory. You know, this sign that Jonathan was looking for in verses 8 through 10 could be seen as a sense of trepidation on the part of Jonathan, in which he was seeking some reassurance from the Lord, and perhaps this is the case. But carefully notice what Jonathan says they would do in these verses. We will pass ourselves over unto them, and we'll discover ourselves unto them. If they say thus unto us, tarry until we come to you, then we will turn around and run the other way. No, what does he say? We will stand still in our place. But if they say thus unto us, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord hath delivered them into our hand. Jonathan did not give any indication that their intent was to retreat. I think the sign he was looking for was, Lord, do you want us to defeat them down here, or do you want us to defeat them up there? I think Jonathan had faith that God would provide the victory one way or another. I think most of us know in our heads that God is able to give the victory. But I know I find it difficult in my own life many times to have that faith that God will give the victory. Now, I love the next part of this story because it reminds me of an action scene in a movie where, you know, you've got the hero who has like one bullet left in his gun and he's surrounded, and yet somehow he's able to take out all of the enemy and comes out completely unscathed. Well, this is no movie. This is real life. And I believe it is because of a divine enablement that Jonathan and his armor bearer take out these 20 guys. And as believers, we have this same promise of divine enablement. As we see these wonderful promises throughout Scripture, promises like, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. What a wonderful comfort that we do not have to face challenges on our own. Through God's divine enablement, we can overcome any challenge. So this divine enablement then leads to our last feature, a definitive victory from God. Look at, again at verse 15. And there was trembling in the host, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the spoilers, they also trembled. And the earth quaked, so it was a very great trembling. That last phrase, as I studied in the original language, has the actual idea of a trembling of God. This incredible conquest, in the face of such formidable challenge, could only be accomplished through faith in following the invincible God that we serve. And this is the same invincible heritage that we have the wonderful privilege to follow. And then we see the appropriate credit given in verse 23. So the Lord saved Israel that day. What a great example of faith in following our heritage. May we seek to do the same in our own lives. The servant's invincible heritage, followed or forsaken? Which will you choose? I'd invite you to bow your heads for a moment. And as you look into your own hearts, I don't know where you would place yourself in these two choices of following or forsaking our invincible heritage. Maybe you're like Saul and you've got some failures that you need to take care of. Maybe you've tried to rationalize your sin. Would you confess that to the Lord? Maybe you're facing some challenges and you're wondering if God is sufficient. Is He sufficient to provide for my school bill? Is He sufficient to get me through my classes? Is He sufficient to help me in my relationships? I don't know what you're facing, but maybe you need to stand still and remember all the righteous acts that the Lord has done for you. He is sufficient. And for all of us, we don't know what formidable challenges we might be facing in the future. But would you commit today that no matter what may come, you will determine to have faith to follow the invincible heritage that God has provided for you? Heavenly Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you for these examples and this challenge that we've received this morning. Lord, may you instill in us a faith in you, a recognition of the wonderful things you've done for us in our past, and how that can give us the courage to know that you are sufficient for our future, no matter what challenges we might face. Lord, may we commit to following you and look forward to the definitive victory that can only come from you, so that someday we might look back and even as we review our own heritage, we can proclaim with thanksgiving, "The Lord saved me that day." Lord, may we commit these two things to our lives and be faithful to follow our invincible heritage. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.